So let's play a game, shall we? You can come up here, which you did, and it's the simplest game. It only has one question. So you can go on the other side here, and you have two options you can pick from. On this side right here, we have a dollar bill. Okay? Not so bad, right? See, this is going to be good. On this side right here, you have a $20 bill. Okay? So here's the thing. You can select the dollar bill right now, take it, and you can sit down, no questions asked. It's yours, you can have it. Or you can wait till the end of the sermon, and then you can take the $20 bill. Okay? Now it's $20, that's a good amount of money. It's intentionally set that high to make the decision difficult. Now I want to make it clear that I'm not bribing you to listen to the sermon. So it's a simple decision that comes down to this. Do you want the $1 bill now, or do you want the $20 bill after the sermon? The $20 bill. Okay, well, you can sit back down. So let me tell you that I'm very thankful you made that decision, because my whole sermon is based on that. This is a variation of the test called the Stanford Marshmallow Test. There was a study done back in the 60s and 70s. And it focused on delayed gratification. There's been a lot of variances since then. But they found that children, the study was performed on children, but they found that children that waited longer had better outcomes as measured by SAT scores, educational attainment, and other factors. But today I'd like to focus on this in a slightly different way. Namely, how do you know that I'm gonna give you that $20? I mean, why didn't you just take the $1 bill? How do you know I'm not going to say, well, I was just kidding. It was just an example for the sermon. I didn't really mean it. How do you have the confidence that I'm going to do what I said I was going to do? Now, Gavin here, he passed up a reward, a small reward, and the expectation that something better would come in the future. And although he had no proof that I was going to do this, I mean, I've never given Gavin any money before, he thought that the better reward would come if he waited. In order for him to pick that $20, he had to have some level of trust, or at least some type of belief, that I was going to do what I said I was going to do. And I'm still on the fence about it. So what does this concept sound like today? Well, obviously we're going to talk about faith. Faith is such a critical component of our spiritual lives that it's impossible to get all aspects of it and how it impacts each and every one of us. So I decided to whittle it down to just the parts that I myself absolutely knew 100% about faith. So in conclusion, faith is good. Now, I don't know if you feel the same way that I do, but as simple as faith is conceptually, it's really hard to grasp in a concrete way. Now, I understand the textbook explanations of faith. I mean, the Bible does literally define the word, so that helps. But when I try to break it down and really, truly understand what faith is, if I have it, if I use it, if I want it, if I display it, then it starts to get a little tricky. And as a result, this sermon isn't going to contain all the answers. Frankly, in a lot of instances, I think I barely even know the questions. I know that without faith, you cannot enter the kingdom of God. But I also know that if you have the faith of a little tiny seed that fits right here on your pinky finger, you could fling a mountain into the ocean. There's just one problem. Ain't none of us flung any mountains into the ocean. At least not that I've ever seen. So I have lots of questions that we're going to talk about today. And included in this list of questions is maybe the most important one of all. What does it mean for you to have faith in your life right now? How does faith change who you are as you sit here with us today? And if we can unravel that question, then perhaps we can all come to a better understanding of faith. And if we look at faith through a variety of perspectives, then maybe we can find an angle that can help reinvigorate us in a new way to help us reach out and connect with God and grow closer to Him. I'd like to open today by turning to Matthew chapter 14. You can turn back there. Matthew chapter 14. This is a familiar passage, one we've read many times, but it's one that's always opened the door for questions for me, specifically in how faith is manifested in someone's life. Now, this is a famous example that we're about ready to read, but I very much wish I could have been there to witness it in real life. But not only that, I wish I could have been there after it took place, because I'm sure that they had conversations and discussed what took place. But in the scriptures we have, it just kind of abruptly ends, and it leaves us trying to extrapolate what it all means. This is the example of Peter walking on water, which is, of course, quite a big deal. Let's pick it up in verse 22 of Matthew 14. 22 of verse 14 says, "Immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he came up on the mountain by himself to pray. Now when evening came, he was alone there." So let's get a little bit of the context of what's happening here. This was an eventful day. I guess probably every day in Jesus Christ and the disciples' life was an eventful day, especially in this point in his ministry. But leading right up to this event, this is where Jesus Christ performs the miracle and feeds the 5,000 plus people with just 5 loaves and 2 fish. And after that day ended, he sent his disciples and the multitude away so that he could pray. So you know the story. There's a storm brewing, and the disciples are struggling to keep control. And I think it was Kurt Hoyer a few weeks ago that gave a great description about how this is so difficult physically with the boats of that era. But I also wanted to call out in verse 25 that said that this is the fourth watch when Jesus walked out to them. So that would have been between the time frame of about 3 to 6 a.m. in the morning, which is the darkest part of the night before the dawn. And they had been fighting the storm for hours. And the disciples had to have been absolutely drained. So in the midst of this, they're all startled, as no doubt we would be too, to see Jesus Christ walking on the water. So let's pick it up in verse 28. Peter answered him, that's Jesus Christ, and said, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come down to you on the water." So he said, "Come." And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him, and said to him, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" Now, I wanted to go to this scripture because this emphasizes something about faith. It's one of the most difficult and simple concepts to understand. Well, what do I mean by that? Well, let's look at the facts. Yes, poor Peter, he didn't make it very far, but, and this is a very big but, he got out of the boat. He must have been exhausted physically and mentally, but he said to Jesus Christ, "If you say it's you, I'll believe you, and I'll come out of the boat." And then he did. And when the reality of the situation started to sink in, pun intended, and he started to sink himself, what was his first reaction? What did he reach for to save his life? Where did he put his trust? Not in the boat, but in Jesus Christ. He didn't make a flying last-ditch effort to jump back into the boat, but instead he called out to Jesus Christ to rescue him. And when I think of faith, I wonder, when I'm physically and emotionally taxed to my limit, do I have enough faith to even get out of the boat? And if I did, and the troubles and the trials mount even stronger against me, would I reach out to Jesus Christ to help? Or would I at least try to get my hand back on the edge of the boat if I could? Would I even have gone as far as Peter did? Well, if I'm honest with myself, I'd have to say no. No. And if I couldn't do that, does that mean that I have no faith? It says, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" I think that cuts a little close to home for me. Well, today, let's pull apart faith. Let's look at the pieces. Let's pick them up and shift them around in our hands and try to get an understanding of what this means, not just from an intellectual point of view, but rather how faith does or does not impact our lives personally. I like to use 3 points to guide us through the message today, 3 different ways of looking at faith. Point number one is, what is faith? Point number one, what is faith? Now, yes, we get a definition of it, but let's see if we can pick up some extra context. Point number two, is faith worth it? Is faith worth it? Now, you might think that's just a slam dunk question there, but there are some powerful beings in this universe that can put together quite a tempting argument the other way. Point number three, how can we build faith? How can we build faith? Well, point number one, what is faith? Well, yes, of course, let's go to Hebrews chapter 11. I think speakers are contractually obligated to either go or reference Hebrews chapter 11 when speaking about faith, and I'm no different. So let's go to Hebrews chapter 11 and start in verse 1. Hebrews chapter 11, starting in verse 1. Hebrews 11, verse 1. It says, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Now, there's a lot to pick apart about this verse, not the least of which is the very first word. Now, we traditionally attribute this book to Paul as the writer, although the exact authorship has been debated. But one thing is for certain, lots of the book feel like Paul's writing. And what I mean by that is that it's difficult to just take an isolated verse out of this book. Here in Hebrews chapter 11, it's no different. It's a standalone scripture, but it's based on what came before it. The word that's translated now here, as in now faith, can also be translated moreover, and it points back to the preceding chapter. And just what are those thoughts in the preceding chapter? In chapter 10, it talks about the law and Christ's sacrifice. It talks about part of the unpardonable sin. It's really a mixture of some things that change between the old and the new covenant Christianity. And then we get to this interesting section here in verse 32. Let's turn back there. Hebrews 10, and we'll pick it up in verse 32. Hebrews 10 and 32. It says, recall the former days in which after you were illuminated, or after you were called, you endured a great struggle with sufferings, partly while you were made a spectacle both by reproaches and tribulations, and partly while you became companions of those who were so treated. For you had compassion on me in my chains, and joyfully accepted the plundering of your goods, knowing that you have a better and enduring possession for yourselves in heaven. So before we even get to the faith chapter, we see that the author is already elaborating on concepts of faith, enduring hardship for the sake of something better to come. Then notice this, verse 35. Therefore, do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward, for you have need of endurance, so that after you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise. That's another facet of faith. For yet a little while, and he who is coming will come and will not tarry. Now the just live by faith, but if anyone draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who draw back to perdition, but of those who believe to the saving of the soul. So what does this mean? What is the author trying to say here? After we have done the will of God, then and only then do we receive the ultimate promise. How that is possible is through faith. And that is the context that leads up to Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 1. In order to do those things, you will need help. And that help is faith. Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 1, you don't have to turn back there. It says that faith towards God is an elementary principle of Christ. And it seems funny to think that faith, something so nuanced and so deep, could be considered an elementary or basic principle. But perhaps one of the reasons it's called that is because faith is the substance or the underpinnings or the support structure which brings about the remembrance of the promises of God. Since we cannot see God, and since we certainly cannot touch or handle or hold the promises that will take place in the future, then faith is a weighing of the evidence that you do have in order to make our decision to follow His way and His way of life. Now, this may sound like a foreign concept to some, but it's really not. We do similar things in many aspects of our lives. For example, when an alleged criminal goes to trial and there are no eyewitnesses, how does the jury come to a decision about their verdict? Well, they weigh the evidence that they do have. Just because they themselves weren't personally at the scene of the crime doesn't mean that they can't objectively analyze the evidence that they do have in order to come to a decision about what they believe took place. Now, one of the interesting things about faith is that it's not requiring us to ignore the evidence. In fact, faith is based on evidence. Carl Sagan, the noted author and agnostic, said, quote, "Faith is believing in something in the absence of evidence," end quote. And I think a lot of people outside of the faith look at us and can think that we believe the same thing. Faith does mean believing in promises you cannot see, but it does not mean that there is no evidence. What is not seen, for example, are the promises of eternal life in God's family. We can't see that because that has not happened yet. But there is plenty that is seen. Plenty of evidence most certainly does exist. Let's read Romans chapter 1. You can turn back there. We'll pick it up in verse 16 of Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1, verse 16 says, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes." Believing this statement itself is faith right there. "For the Jew first and also for the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith." Now notice these next three verses, because Paul lays out what should be seen and what should be understood as evidence for those with faith. Verse 18, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." There is ample proof that there is a God in heaven. Faith is the belief of that evidence. And by faith, we can know that God is true, and therefore what God says is the truth, and therefore God will deliver on His promises. But what else do we know about faith? We know that the amount of faith is not constant. It can grow and shrink. It's not a binary attribute, either you have it or you don't. We've already read one example of Jesus Christ telling someone that they had a little faith, but there's the other side of this coin as well. Let's turn back to Matthew chapter 8. Matthew chapter 8. And while you're turning back there, I wanted to point out that there are 29 instances of Jesus Christ using the word faith in the Gospels, 29. And I went through and counted to see if there were more positive examples or more negative examples. Anyone have any guesses as to which way it leaned, positive or negative? Well, some of these usages are companion scriptures, and a few could go either way, so it's not a perfect science. But by my count, there were more positive than negative, 16 to 11, with a few that were neutral. That kind of surprised me, actually. And this is one of those positive examples here in Matthew chapter 8, starting in verse 5. Matthew chapter 8, starting in verse 5. It says, "Now when Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, pleading with him, saying, 'Lord, my servant is lying at home paralyzed, dreadfully tormented.'" Now, another interesting part about Jesus Christ's usage of faith is how many positive examples are actually of Gentiles. So you can look that up on your own, but that also is another interesting facet. Verse 7, and Jesus said to him, I will come and heal him. And the centurion answered and said, Lord, I'm not worthy that you should come under my roof, but only speak the word, and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man under authority, having soldiers under me. And I say to this one, go, and he goes. And I say to another, come, and he comes. And to my servant, do this, and he does it. And when Jesus heard it, he marveled. And he said to those who followed, assuredly, I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel. Now, what a great story here. The centurion knew that Jesus Christ was capable of healing his servant, so he went to him and he simply asked. Now, to understand why this is such a great demonstration of faith, let's contrast this with an example just a few verses later. Still in Matthew 8, but let's go down to verse 23 through 26. Matthew 8, 23 said, now when he got in a boat, his disciples followed him. So this is just a little bit later on in the day. Verse 24, and suddenly a great tempest arose on the sea, so that the boat was covered with waves, but he was asleep. Then his disciples came to him and awoke him, saying, Lord, save us, we're perishing. And he said to them, why are you fearful, O you of little faith? And he arose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was great calm. Now both the centurion and the disciples both came to Jesus Christ and asked him to fix their problems. The difference in how one of these examples was one of great faith and the other, which is of little faith, is how they internally evaluated the evidence. Both groups saw many things that convinced them that Jesus Christ was someone that could help. But notice verse 27 here, Matthew 8, 27. So the men marveled, saying, who can this be that even the winds and the sea obey him? They might have come to Jesus Christ to ask for help, but they didn't believe. They didn't have the confidence or the trust that Christ was capable of all things. And as a result, when Jesus Christ rebuked the winds and the sea, they were amazed because they had no idea this is something that he was capable of. It had not crossed their minds. Both of these groups did have some faith in Jesus Christ. They both went to him. But the disciples, in this instance, had a limited view of what was possible. The centurion simply said, if you want to do it, just say the word. I might not understand it, but I know that if you say yes, it will happen, plain and simple. These two differences also point out a very subtle difference about faith. And that is the difference about what God is capable of and what God wills to do. The centurion knew that Christ was capable, and he asked if Jesus willed it. The disciples weren't 100% sure that Christ was capable, but they assumed that he would swoop in and fix it. A classic example that demonstrates the difference is our friends Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in Daniel chapter 3. You can turn back there, but you remember the story. King Nebuchadnezzar built this huge golden image and required that people bow down and worship it. This was a problem for our three friends, especially when their enemies brought this to the king's attention. So you know the story, but let's pick up some of the nuance here, starting in verse 13 of Daniel 3. Daniel 3, starting in verse 13. It says, then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up? Dropping down to verse 16. So these three answered and said to king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God whom we serve is what? Is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. So this is the gold standard for understanding that faith is not dependent on God doing your wishes. And I think it's easy to get caught up in that trap because we've all felt that way. And it's tempting to think that faith is believing that God will do something for you when you want it. We've all fallen into that thinking, I'm sure. It's like someone who's facing a trial. It's tempting to say, well, just be patient, have faith. God's going to open the doors for you and resolve it. Now, God does indeed bless us, and God does indeed care about our well-being, but faith does not mean that God will give you exactly what you're looking for or in the exact time frame you are looking for it. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had no illusions about this. They had faith of who God was and what he is capable of. And they knew that God certainly could have saved them, but their faith wasn't dependent on it. They knew that at the end of the day, their trial would no longer impact them. But they didn't know if it would be because they would be delivered or because they would be dead. It's an incredible mindset to have. It's an incredible, difficult mindset to have. And all that leads to my next point, because this is where it starts to get complicated, at least for me. Point number two is faith worth it? Is faith worth it? And perhaps you might be thinking that, why is this even a question? This has got to be the easiest, most obvious question in the history of all sermons. But this is certainly a question you will have to answer for yourself, because it is consistently clear throughout the Bible that working on faith and increasing it in your life is not an easy task. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It's promised to be difficult. The rest of the faith chapter in Hebrews chapter 11, we are given a long list of individuals, both by name and by example, that did not have the easiest life. Those heroes of faith did not necessarily live life to the fullest or in any sort of luxury at all. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were thrown into the fiery furnace, and they were rescued, and that's great. And that's why they're in every children's illustrated Bible, because it has a great ending. But what if it would have turned out differently, as the three of them clearly knew it could have? What about all the others throughout time that were not rescued? History is full of martyrs that stood up for their God and his way of life and were not supernaturally saved. Even in Acts, just days or weeks after the church was founded on Pentecost, Stephen was falsely accused of blasphemy, brought before the people, and stoned. Having true faith is hard. It's fought down in the trenches, where oftentimes you make progress inch by painful inch. Have you ever noticed the difference between how faith is handled in the Old Testament versus the New Testament? Now, to be sure, the Bible is a unified text, and concepts and principles are consistent throughout the entirety of the Bible. However, when it came to working with a called out group of people, the nation of Israel in the Old Testament, and the spiritual body in the New Testament, the practical application of faith was applied differently. In the old King James Version of the Bible, the word translated into faith is in over 230 verses in the New Testament. In the Old Testament, in the old King James Version, it's in two. Now, there are other words that are similar. There's different translations that have different instances. But the point is that the concept of faith is dealt with differently between the Old and the New Testaments, or more appropriately, the Old and the New Covenants. Let's notice something in Deuteronomy chapter 28. Deuteronomy chapter 28. This is the blessings and cursings chapter, and there are a lot of similar passages throughout the history of Israel. But this one, I think, sums it up quite nicely. And when God was working with Israel, he gave them his credentials, he showed them who he was, and then he said, these are my rules. Do them, you will be blessed. Don't do them, you will be cursed. Let's pick it up, Deuteronomy 28, verse 1. Deuteronomy 28 and verse 1. It says, now it shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments, which I command you today, that the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth. And all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you, because you obey the voice of the Lord your God. And then the chapter goes on with specifics. Let's drop down to verse 12 here. still in Deuteronomy 28, verse 12, and the Lord will open to you his good treasure, the heavens, to give you rain, to give the rain to your land in its season, and to bless all the work of your hand. You shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow. Now, you still had to have faith and trust that God was going to keep his end of the deal. But the results were very clear, they were very obvious, and they were implemented quickly. If you obey God, God will water your crops. If you disobey God, as it says in verse 24, you get nothing. The land turns to powder and to dust. Now, this is the ultimate of what's called the health and wealth doctrine. You do good, you're rewarded. You do bad, you get punished. And this thinking played into the book of Job, if you recall, because his friends saw all these horrible things that were happening to him, and they said, well, you must be doing something wrong. There must be something that you were sinning about. You're somehow bad because all these things are happening to you. And it's very easy to extend that same thought process to the topic of faith within our spiritual journey. If things are going well, that's because you're doing the right things and God is blessing you. If things are going poorly, it's because you aren't doing the right things and God is providing the trials to teach you a lesson. And there certainly can be instances where God blesses or God provides a trial, no doubt about that. But we don't have that same sort of health and wealth agreement in the New Covenant. In fact, God demonstrates that faith in him is more than just obey and get a treat, disobey and get spanked. Let's turn back to Hebrews chapter 11 once more, because nowhere is this more clear than in the faith chapter itself. Hebrews chapter 11, let's drop down this time to verse 32. Hebrews 11, verse 32 says, what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to the flight the armies of the alien. Women received their dead, raised to life again. And then don't you wish it just kind of stopped right there? They had faith, they followed God's way of life, they called out to him, and God delivered. He gave them the rain, he blessed them, he protected them, he intervened on their behalf. End of story. But no, it goes on, doesn't it? Still in verse 35. And others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Still others had trial of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn in two, were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth. And all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise. So let me ask you this question once more. Was it worth it? Now, obviously, we can't ask those individuals right now. But if we can put ourselves a bit in their shoes, a logical person would have to look at these people, see that they fully committed to something. They suffered terribly for it. And then they didn't get their reward. At least they hadn't received it at that moment. But through faith, they held firm that God was all powerful and would reward them in his time. Faith is hard. Unless you go through the tough situations, it's really difficult to know just how much faith you really have. Wouldn't it be easier to just never go through any hard things? Never come across trials, tribulations, where you needed to rely on God's strength? Just live in the now. Not worry about the future. Well, I guess it depends on what kind of person you are. Are you the person that picks the dollar or waits for the 20? Of course, when it comes to eternal life, the rewards that are promised with it, it's silly to think of the decision between 1 and 20. In reality, it's more like a choice between 1 and unlimited money. So I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that all of us think that working on faith is important. All of us want to grow in faith, increase in faith. And if that's the case, how do we do it? Well, point number three is, how can we build faith? How can we build faith? If we know what faith is, we've decided that it is worth it, although hard, then how do we build it? Because there are some quick and easy ways, and then there are some tried and true ways. Unfortunately, some of the quick and easy ways can also sometimes lead to issues down the road. Let's say, for example, you're trying to lose weight. It could be any difficult task, but I'll just say losing weight because I need to lose weight. And let's say you put together this amazing training plan. You have great eating habits lined up. Your exercise regimen is to your liking. You found all the right songs to listen to, and you just get fired up during your workout. And if you put all of this into action, and then you start to see results, what happens? Well, you feel more excited. You feel encouraged. That positive behavior was reinforced. But what if the inverse happens? What if you do all those things and nothing happens? Or worse, what if it goes the other way? Well, then you start to feel discouraged. You think that maybe it's not worth it. Something like losing weight is a very long-term goal. It takes a lot of time, energy, and effort to make it happen. The tricky part is when we apply this same principle and use it when building faith. Now, if we're working hard on prayer and Bible study, let's say, and you're starting to try to fast once a month, you've really got some of your bad habits under control, and you're proactively working on the fruits of the Spirit, and then, through no fault of your own, on your work to one day, you get in a car accident. Now, if God heals you, He supernaturally protects you in some way, or does in fact swoop down and intervene in an obvious way, that's fantastic. And on occasion, He does very much do that. And when it happens, no doubt your faith will increase drastically. But what if He doesn't? Now, I'm sorry, if you build your faith for specific instances, events, or tasks, then when God does intervene, it does quickly build up that faith. But if God doesn't, then it can equally tear down your faith. Uh-oh, I'm getting close to the line here. Now, I experienced this exact same thing with Olivia. We had one instance in the hospital that I can remember that I actually needed help, and I went to God with it. Now, I wasn't asking God to completely heal Olivia. I wasn't asking God to intervene on the whole cancer floor. I was just asking for God to stop physical pain temporarily, just to get some relief. And now, it didn't seem like I was asking for too much. It seemed entirely reasonable. I wasn't even asking it for myself. And I 100% knew that God was capable. And then when God said no, my faith was damaged. A big old chunk of it was ripped right out of the side. And you know what I thought? I thought, God let me down. I'm not saying this is right. I'm just saying this is what I felt. And I thought, I've been in the church my entire life. You know, I've not done everything perfect, but I've at least tried to go in the right direction. And never before can I ever remember fervently asking for anything. And then the one time I do, the one time, nothing happens. So I thought, what is the point? What's the point? When you build faith in that way, that God is an insurance plan, or that God, you obey God so that you can have Him in your back pocket, this is the result. Because God does intervene. God does involve Himself in our lives. That much is very clear from our own experiences. But that's not what faith is about. And that's not how you build lasting faith. But at the same time, it's natural to think like this, isn't it? Let's turn to Mark chapter 8. Mark chapter 8. There are a lot of examples that I could have picked that are similar, but this one's very concise. Mark chapter 8, verse 11. Mark chapter 8, verse 11. It says, then the Pharisees came out and began to dispute with Him, seeking from Him a sign from heaven, testing Him. And He sighed deeply in His spirit. And He said, why does this generation seek a sign? Assuredly, I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation. And then He left, getting into the boat again, departed to the other side. How many times would people say, if I could only see this sign, I would believe. If you would only do this or that, I would believe. Even when Jesus Christ was in the middle of being crucified, people would say, if you just bring yourself down, that's all I need, I'll believe. Faith should be built on who God is, not what he does for us right now. There are no guarantees that God will directly intervene in any specific event, but there are absolutely guarantees about who he is and what his promises are. So how do we build that lasting faith, surely and slowly, that survives the long haul? Well, one obvious way is to pray and ask God for more faith. I think this one is pretty well understood. I don't think I can add more to it. But just to communicate with God and ask for more faith is a critical action item. Let's notice this example just a little bit further in Mark chapter 9. Mark chapter 9, we'll pick it up in verse 17. Mark chapter 9, picking up verse 17. Says, then one of the crowd answered and said, teacher, I brought you my son who has a mute spirit. And wherever it seizes him, it throws him down. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. So I spoke to your disciples that they should cast him out, but they could not. Dropping down to verse 21. So he, that's Jesus Christ, asked his father, how long has this been happening to him? And he said, from childhood. And often he has thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you could do anything, have compassion on us and help us. This is a great example because this individual was not without faith. He knew that there was something about Jesus Christ, and he did bring his son to the disciples. However, I'm sure his optimism faded pretty quickly when the disciples couldn't do anything for him. He had the roots of faith. He wanted more faith. Let's see what happens. Verse 23, and Jesus said to him, if you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes. And immediately the father of the child cried out and said with tears, Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. It's entirely appropriate to ask God for faith, not just for ourselves, but also for one another. Paul, the Apostle Paul, on many occasions says he prays for faith for others. He sets a wonderful example of what we can do right here in our own home. Another way that we can grow in faith can be gleaned from Ephesians chapter 6. Let's go back there. We'll read a few verses, starting in verse 10. This is the armor of God section in Ephesians chapter 6. Again, we'll start in verse 10. Ephesians 6, verse 10. It says, finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Now, we've read this many times. Paul then goes on to recount a few of the different pieces of armor. Then we get to verse 16. Verse 16 of Ephesians 6. And it says, above all. Now, not that the other pieces weren't important, but this is the key one here. Above all, taking the shield of faith with which you will be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one. Now, there are a couple interesting things that I find here that relates to our points today. Verse 16 is towards the end of the armor components, and it's the first piece that is external to the body. The first set, the waist of truth, the breastplate of righteousness, the feet with the gospel of peace, all of those are armor components that go directly on the body. The shield is something that is not attached. You have to carry it. Now, the purpose of a shield is to protect you when you are in areas of danger. And unlike the other pieces of armor, it's not primarily an offensive piece. Well, how does a shield actually work? It guards, it deflects, and it's the first line of defense. You want the shield to take the first blow, not your helmet. Likewise, faith does all three of those things. Through faith, we are called to mind who God is. And with that in our minds, we remember his commands, his way of life, and his promises. And those three things help guard and deflect Satan's spiritual attacks that drive us off course. Another aspect of this shield is the way it was constructed for the Roman army at the time of this writing. I want to read this piece of commentary on the shield This would have been in the minds of the readers of Ephesians. It says this, quote, "The shield was an impressive line of defense. Because of its sheer size, some were 3.5 feet tall and almost 3 feet wide, soldiers were afforded a great deal of protection from enemies. Because of its slight curve, it was able to deflect attacks without transferring the full force of the assault to the man holding the shield. Because of its boss, that was a large protruding knob in the front, it was able to deflect even the most vicious blows and function in a limited offensive capacity as a means of knocking an opponent backwards." And then there's just this one more comment, and I hope it drives home a point about these shields that might be lost today. The Roman military had an inventive and a very effective tactic that made use of their large shield. When an enemy would begin firing arrows and other projectiles at the armies, the soldiers would close ranks into a rectangular array called a testiro, or the turtle formation, and those on the outside would use their shields to create a wall around the perimeter, and those in the middle would raise their shields over their heads to protect everyone from the airborne missiles. The result was a formidable human tank that could not be stopped except through tremendous effort. The last way to build up our faith, or the last one we'll focus on, is to join our shields together. There is a reason why God calls people to a fellowship and wants people together. There is a point to it. Jude chapter 1 and verse 3, Jude chapter 1 and verse 3 says, "Beloved, while I was very diligent to write to you concerning our common salvation, I found it necessary to write to you, exhorting you to contend earnestly for the faith which was once delivered for all, which was once for all delivered to the saints." Together, by uplifting each other, by encouraging each other, by strengthening each other, we link our shields and become a formidable spiritual tank. Separately, isolated, we can be weak. United together, we can be strong. Now, all of these ways to increase our faith are designed to guide us to a deeper level of understanding and come to the realization that God is sovereign. We are not on the same plane as Him. He does not think the same way we think. And the more we understand God's amazing glory, then the more we understand that He is in control of all things, and He cares about our lives. He is capable and trustworthy to fulfill His promises to us in the future. Well, our experiment from earlier today does a lot to demonstrate this spiritual concept in a physical way. Unfortunately, it looks like it's going to cost me $20 to teach it to you. I think that's money well spent. Now, Gavin here was faced with the decision. Take a reward now, a small reward, that $1, and be done. Or you could wait and receive the $20 later, and I'm almost done. In order to make an intelligent decision, Gavin had to weigh a lot of different factors. First, does he have the confidence that I will actually give him either? What are my credentials? Or said in another way, how does he process my character when evaluating if I will do what I say I will do? But even after that, Gavin has to evaluate if the $20 is even worth it. Is it valuable enough to be worthwhile? Or is the whole exercise just pointless? When faced with this decision in your own life, and you will be faced with this decision in your own life, do you pick the dollar option or the 20? Do you see the value in the choices, and do you validate the being that is presenting them to you? And above all, is that reward worth it to you? Our faith in God requires us to know that He is the all-powerful creator of the universe, and that He is who He said He is, and that He is capable of fulfilling the promises He has set out in front of us. We have no evidence of those promises to come. We can't take those promises out of a case, look them over in our hands, and perform some critical analysis on them. But we aren't in any way lacking evidence of God. It's all around us, both at the micro level and the macro level. we see the evidence of God's handiwork. And if we follow his way of life and receive his Holy Spirit, then we can see the evidence of the changing character even within our own life. Surely God has provided an abundance of evidence, but even so, we have to believe it. Faith is an elementary spiritual principle, and one that I'll probably never fully understand. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6 says, "Without faith, it's impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him." Well, let us work together, diligently seek him together. And if we can do that, then God will pour out his blessings upon us forever as members of his family. I think that's worth the wait. And if we have faith in God, we know that his promise is truly a kept promise.